Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the Meet the Author show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next 30 minutes, I'll be your host. And tonight, my guest is Lisa Sweetingham. And Lisa is a journalist and formerly covered a lot of high-profile court cases for Court TV Online. And she's written her first book, and the title is Chemical Cowboys. And it is, I'm sure, a very exciting book, although I haven't gotten my copy of it yet. But I'm going to introduce Lisa now. And Lisa, welcome to Meet the Author.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Denny.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And why don't people would rather hear you talk than me, so why don't you tell us about Chemical Cowboy?
Sure. Essentially, it's a true story, and it encompasses about 4 years of my own reporting and research and writing and traveling around the world to get the never-before-told story of the secret undercover operations that led to the capture of an Israeli ecstasy kingpin and the toppling of a brutal Tel Aviv mob boss. It's kind of a complicated story to tell because it covers such a broad, it sort of covers the ecstasy era, and it looks at it from the point of view of like all the club kids who were taking the drug in New York, and it also follows sort of what the Israeli police were doing in Israel when they were trying to kind of bring down their own mob bosses. And but what I've done to tell the story in a more interesting way than just, you know, case studies is I follow a New York DEA agent named Bob Gatney, who's still undercover. In fact, there are a lot of photos in the book, and all the photos of Bob his eyes have to be blacked out because, you know, he still does undercover operations. But I follow his story because it was really quite compelling once I got to know him. He was really the first guy in DEA back in 1995 who started chasing after these drug dealers. And the way he did it was he and a partner infiltrated New York's top nightclubs disguised as gay ravers. And, you know, they got to know the scene and the players, the buyers and the dealers. And what they discovered was that it really was much bigger than just this kind of small enclave of club kids and ravers who were doing ecstasy. It was a much, much bigger network. And, you know, Bob Gagne really kind of was the one who led these cases that turned into international cases where you had cops in Holland and Germany and Belgium and Israel coming together to take down this billion-dollar network. And so the book kind of covers the ecstasy era through Bob Gagne's eyes.
Well, 4 years, you said, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Well, first, before I get into that, if anybody would like to ask Lisa a question or make a comment, you can get through to us here at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And also, if anybody in the chat room has a question for Lisa, I'll be glad to relay it to her. Lisa, now, I'm sure myself and the listeners would be interested in knowing how you get the approvals or permission, or how did you get the ability to be able to write the story as far as getting cooperation of the DEA and so forth?
Yeah, no, that's a really important question. And you're right, I really had to get DEA's approval to write this book the way I wanted to. Also, I had to get the approval of Israeli National Police because, you know, I went out there to visit them and learn more about how they worked with the American agents. And it's not something that you can just kind of walk in and say, hey, let me see your case files. Once I kind of got a sense of what the stories were about, I should back up. Years ago, I had read these fascinating stories in the New York Times about these young, Hasidic, ultra-Orthodox teenagers out of Brooklyn who were getting caught at the airport trying to smuggle ecstasy into the country. And it was fascinating because, you know, they're typically very sheltered, and so why were they involved in drug dealing? And many years later, when I was with Court TV, a source encouraged me to kind of dig deeper. So I went to DEA, and, you know, I really showed them my cards. I didn't pretend to be looking for one thing while I was really looking for something else. I really let them know that I was interested in their ecstasy cases, and that I wanted to meet the agents who were involved in those cases, and that I, you know, that I thought there was at least a magazine article to be written and possibly a book. So it actually took me about a year, a little over a year, of just sitting at the head of New York DEA and talking to the different agents before they really trusted me. And then at that point, the head of New York DEA, a man named John Gilbride, he called headquarters and he vouched for me. And he said, you know, I spent many, many days talking to John Gilbride and, you know, even had drinks with him and got to know him as a person. And I think that really makes the difference. So, you know, when you're trying to approach a topic like this where you've got government documents that issue classified documents and things that no one's ever looked at before, you really have to let the people that you're dealing with know that you're not looking to do a quick hit, that you're really engaged and you're really interested in doing something complex and involved, and that you want to show both sides. So I made it really clear to him that, you know, I wasn't going to write a book that would promote DEA, but I would be fair and tell both sides of the issue. So they just trusted me at that point. So that was sort of what it took to get to that level. And then once I did get the cooperation, I mean, it was amazing to be able to sit in a back office at DEA headquarters in New York and just basically look through case file after case file, like a ceiling-high stack of files with photographs and tape-recorded conversations and, I mean, stuff that no one had ever seen. So it was actually really fun.
So during this year, or about a year it took you to get the approval or from DEA to participate, were you confident all the way through that you were going to be successful, or did you ever have doubts that maybe they were going to give you a thumbs down?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, all along the way. You're almost sort of like groping in the dark because, you know, and it wasn't just whether or not they were going to ultimately cooperate. It was also whether or not I was even going to be able to get a book deal. So, you know, we could get to a certain point where they say, you know, okay, actually, in fact, I'm trying to think now, I wrote the proposal while I was getting to know these people. And I think if I got the timing right, I was given we secured a book deal. My agent and I secured a book deal with Random House, probably, you know, like in around 2005 to 2004. And at that point, that's when I really had to go back to DEA and say, okay, like, this is happening. Do I have your cooperation? So I didn't even really get their full cooperation by the time I got a book deal. And, you know, I could have done it without their cooperation. It just wouldn't have been as rich of a story. And there would have been a lot of sort of missing details that would have been really hard for me to get without their cooperation.
Yeah, something would have been lacking. It would almost have to be, you know, if you were doing it somewhat limited on your sources of information and so on.
Yeah.
You said that you were upfront with them when you made your proposal and told them exactly what you intended to do, what you wanted to do. And I got to tell you that I did, well, I don't want to compare this to getting into the access to the stuff you did, but I wanted to do a history of the Las Vegas Police Department at one point. And I had the opinion that I needed their cooperation. Again, like you, I probably couldn't do it without them, but certainly it would greatly enhance the project to have them involved. And when I had to go see the powers that be at Metro, I went in and told them, just like you did, I said, this is not going to be a puff piece for Metro or a promotion piece for Metro, but I'm going to be fair and, you know, tell it like it happened and so on and so forth. And it didn't take me anywhere near a year to get an answer, but but I think that is the only way to go. In my opinion, what you did, and I think if you don't do that, it seems to me if they catch you, you know, you're toast. I mean, if you
I really agree with you. I feel like I think a lot of people, they watch TV shows about journalists who, you know, are work under cloak and dagger operations, and I just think that doesn't really work in the real world. I mean, you can, and sometimes you have to, if you've uncovered some kind of government malfeasance, but I think for the most part, and I would agree with you, especially with Vegas, it's like you kind of have to just go in there and say, look, this is what I'm planning to do. You know, this is what I need. And I'm going to tell you along the way if I hear about stuff that suspect. And, I'm going to ask for answers. And I think they respect that more because it's like you're honest with each other.
Right. And like you said, once they did trust you, then it really opened up some great avenues for you. I mean, it had to be just a tremendous feeling to do what you were able to do, sit in on these sessions and talk to these investigators, these agents, and look at the files and hear the recordings and all that. I mean, to me, I'm interested in investigative and law enforcement things. And I'm just salivating here thinking about the opportunity to be able to do that. So I really envy you. And
I know,
and
I know you have a real rich background in that. So trust me, you know, like I'm on the same plane with you. It's very exciting, especially when you know you get to like go shoot in the range, or you get to kind of tour the lab and see them, you know, analyzing drugs. And I mean, it was a wonderful feeling.
Now, this is your first book, full-length book?
Yes.
And how you followed the agents and were involved for about 4 years of that. Now, you were writing as you went. Was that you were doing the manuscript as you went along, or
well,
did you
I
have
kinda,
to do everything after?
Yeah, I kind of what I did was... you know, I don't know that the way I write is the most efficient way, but I really circle something, and I really try to just dive into the world that I'm covering. So I did a ton of research, and I had a basic structure in mind. I had a 30-page book proposal that we used to secure the book deal, and then I did a chapter outline after we got the book deal. And so that was kind of my basic structure, so I kind of knew what was going to go in each chapter. But I have to tell you that by the time I sat down to actually write the thing, which wasn't until that last year and a half, closer to a year, it veered off of my original structure quite a bit, especially because I found some really interesting information about 3 months before my first draft deadline. And when about this fantastic Tel Aviv mob boss whose prosecution really signaled the end of the ecstasy era. And I knew I had to go to Israel and learn more about him and include him at the end of the book. And it turned my structure topsy-turvy, and I had to just, like, buckle in and kind of rewrite parts for those last 3 months. But I'm really glad I did. It was a good addition. But yeah, I think I spent about a year and a half at the end writing. I didn't write as I went along. I just kept really meticulous notes.
When you had to deal with, you said you had to go to Israel for part of the story. How was cooperation other than the DEA? Did you have to get other agencies or entities involved?
Yeah, I also spoke to prosecutors, so I had one of the top assistant U.S. attorneys at the time in the Eastern District of New York was a woman named Linda Lacewell. She now works for Governor Cuomo, and so, is that right, is he governor or attorney general? I'm blanking. Governor Cuomo, so she needed to get approval to even talk to me about anything that she did on the cases. And then I also got approval from Israeli National Police. There's a man named Gadi Shed who is like a walking encyclopedia of organized crime, and he is the head of all intelligence for Israeli police. Brilliant guy. He's in his 50s. You know, he gets up at 5 o'clock every morning to swim laps in the pool, and he's traveled all over the world, and he's been involved in many, many international drug bust operations. And he was the one that everybody said to me, if you go to Israel, you have to meet Gadi. So he and I talked on the phone quite a bit, and at some point he was able to, once he felt that he could trust me and I had the good word of people he knew in America, he went to his boss, the commissioner, and asked for approval. And then once they agreed, then I flew out there and I spent a couple weeks just meeting with, I mean, Gotti was fantastic. He took me to sites of, you know, mafia assassinations. He brought me in to talk to their money laundering experts and their intelligence experts. He introduced me to top generals and former commissioners who talked about the ecstasy cases and their experiences. And we toured a lot of the homes of the, we didn't go into the homes, but we went to the sites of the residences of the top mob bosses in Israel. So it was very important to get Israeli National Police's cooperation.
Did you ever feel at any point, did you get anything that was dangerous? I mean, did you ever in any situations that were you uncomfortable with?
There were, you know, some of my, we haven't talked about this yet, but some of my sources were former drug dealers, and I suspect they might still be drug dealers, but men and women who were involved in the trade, who some lived in America and some lived abroad. There were, you know, I had a couple of people that threatened me, but it was more sort of posturing to let me know that there were certain things they were going to tell me that I could not reveal. I did have a situation where I was in Romania, and I was meeting with a source who was one of the top dealers, sort of the height of ecstasy, and he worked out of Amsterdam in Romania, and he was involved with a lot of the big guys who were exporting, you know, millions of dollars worth of pills into the States. And from what I understood, we were going to meet, you know, on a street corner in Bucharest and kind of walk around and look at some of the places that where he used to work and just kind of talk. And but when I show up, we walk for about, you know, a couple blocks, and then he takes me to his car, and it turns out we're going to take a ride.
Uh-oh.
yeah, but, you know, it's like you get a feeling about someone. It's funny, the agent whose story I follow, Bob Gagné, he talks about it, and I write about it in the book. He does something where he has this thing that he does. Whenever he meets someone new, he gives them a threshold assessment where the minute they walk in the door or they come into his purview, he's looking at them, and he's looking in their eyes, and he's looking at the way they talk and how they act, and not even so much what they're saying, and he has a really good sense of whether he can trust that person. And, you know, I kind of have that same sort of feeling. And this guy, the Romanian drug dealer, I just sense that I was going to be okay. And, you know, I'm here talking to you today, so I guess it went okay.
Your judgment was right. don't you think, you know, you can have... either as a police officer or government investigator or agent, or as a journalist or a private eye and so forth, you can have a lot of training and experience. But going back to this trust issue and so forth, don't you think there's some people just have a gift, if you will, or a talent or an ability to be able to make these kinds of judgments, nothing they learn really in a textbook, but they just have something that they're able to accurately, thankfully, evaluate the person they're dealing with or the situation they're in and come to make some good decisions. I'm just awestruck by that.
Yeah, and I want maybe you. I mean, you've probably been in some hairy situations too in your work, and I suspect that maybe you have that sense too. But I know that you know, I'm a real studier of human nature, and one of the things that I noticed about Bob Gagné, who's really good at determining whether he can trust someone, is that he came from a really big family where there were a lot of kids constantly, you know. They had rivals for seconds at dinner. His father was an alcoholic and never knew when he might go into one of his rages. And in a sense, Bob grew up always watching the adults in the room and watching how they talked and how they acted and their body language and having a real sense of, like, what they were going to do next And I think that was sort of his early training as an undercover, to be able to walk into a room and kind of morph into whoever he needed to be in that situation, and while still very carefully looking at the people around him to determine whether or not, you know, someone was going to react unexpectedly.
Before we get any further along, Lisa, if anyone is interested in learning more about you or your book or ordering a book, could you have any website information or contact information you can give us?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, the book is available anywhere books are sold, and but you can also find out more about it at my website, which is lisasweetingham.com. And there's also, gosh, a couple of chapter excerpts, so you can even read a few chapters first to decide if you like it and want to buy it. And there's, you know, other stuff there about the book and about my research into the book. And that's lisasweetingham.com.
And is it possible you get an autographed copy? Do you can people?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Copy? If someone wants an autographed copy, they can just email me through my website, and we can work that out.
Okay. Great. I need to. I get so wrapped up when I talk to people about investigations and so forth, I lose track of other things sometimes. And the show is about writing and about authors, so I want to spend a few minutes, if you don't mind, talking about writing.
Sure, and I'd love to.
If you had to give one piece of advice to an aspiring writer, we all think we have a book in us, and most of us at some point actually think about writing that. Not many of us do, but a lot of people think about it. And if you had one piece of advice to give to a writer, a new writer, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think there's so many kind of different little pieces of advice that I've received along the way. But, you know, I think part of it depends on whether you're talking about fiction or nonfiction, because, you know, in the publishing world, they're both approached a little bit differently. I know with fiction, you kind of have to just write it and then hope it sells. With nonfiction, you can write a proposal and try to sell that and then get an advance to write the book. So that's a little bit more helpful in terms of the time investment. But, you know, I'm thinking about a piece of advice that I got once from a playwright who's a really a prolific writer. And it sort of demystified the writing process for me, and I'll break it down for you. Basically, you know, a lot of times as writers, people will tell us, just write, you know, just get up and write. And that's all fine and good, but, you know, you're tired, you've got stuff you're doing all day, you've got work, maybe you've got kids. The thing that really helped me when I was writing Comical Cowboys was to break it down to a goal of pages per day. So that, in fact, you know, whatever the precious things I needed to do to get into the writing mode, whether it was cleaning up my workspace or answering all my emails or brewing the perfect cup of coffee or whatever distractions that, you know, keep you from sitting down and actually putting the words on the laptop, do all those things. But at some point, like, have a time during the day that you just start to write. And if you focus on, like, not so much constantly writing and editing and writing and editing yourself, but if you focus on just getting down like 3 pages a day, you know, by the end of a couple of months, you've got yourself a book. So for me, that was a huge thing, to just like kind of break it down. I knew my book was going to be a certain amount of pages, and so I would break it down to like, okay, if I can, you know, write 10 pages a day, I'll have it done by this date. And it really it made it just less of a precious act, which I think, you know, we're in danger of doing sometimes as writers.
Sure. I remember I went to a writer's conference several years ago, one of the first ones that I attended, and one of the speakers were talking about this very thing, about a discipline, if you will, if you want to be a writer. And I remember quite vividly the first thing out of the speaker's mouth was, get rid of the solitaire games. That's when all the people were playing with a solitaire game or some kind of card game. And, you know, you're talking about getting rid of distractions. And that was his first word of advice. Get rid of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you won't end up getting anything done.
Like, for me, it's Facebook. You know, like, I discovered Facebook, like, just about around the time I was, like, finishing the book, and that was a real distraction, and I had to just, like, turn off email, turn off the web, and just focus on that. But, yeah, get rid of the solitaire. Really good advice.
And another thing, at least this is what I found, that a lot of authors think, when I was started tackling my first manuscript, was that the writing was the hard part, and the research, you know, depending what you're writing, but getting the manuscript done, getting the information you needed, and getting a manuscript out there was the main thing. And once that was done, you were done. I mean, then it was going to be an agent or an editor, and blah blah blah, and publicity person, and everything was done. I came to the conclusion, however, that I was way off base on that, that no matter how good your book is, how good your manuscript is, if you don't market it, it's kind of worthless. I mean, you know, if you're writing, if you want to get the story out there, plus a financial benefit. So I don't know what your feeling is, but my feeling is that marketing is probably on an equal footing with doing the writing. You can't just drop the ball once the book is out. You have to make your appearances, if you know if that's what it takes, do your signings or give talks or whatever it is. But you can't just curl up on your couch.
No, I completely agree. And it's kind of sad to me because, like the publishing house or however you do it, it's like they'll spend so much time and money to, like, get this book printed and ready to go, and then they really don't, you know, I was very fortunate. I had a good house behind me, but they still didn't really market it as much as they could have or do as much publicity as they could have. And what I discovered was as soon as I was done writing it, and then there was the editing and procuring photos, and you have to do everything yourself, and then you have to turn off the writer hat, like put down the writing hat, and then you have to put on your sales hat, and you have to do things that you thought you that are just sort of like things you didn't want to do. Like, for instance, you have to call all of your friends that you know who might be involved in the media, anyone who works in a magazine or a newspaper or a TV show, and you have to beg them to have you on to talk about your book, and you have to be a real salesperson. And for me, that was just really difficult. But, you know, at some point you just get used to it and you just decide this is what I have to do. And because if you don't, nobody's going to know about your book.
Absolutely, and I even now when I talk to people at the writers groups and so forth, I say, well, I've come to the conclusion it's not just writing; it's the business of writing. There's more to it than keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, there's the marketing and the research. I don't know how many books I've read, more than I wish I had read, where the research was so pathetic that the story just flopped. I mean, there were so many errors that I couldn't continue through the book because once I got burned two or three times with facts that were blatantly in error, I kind of lost interest, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, and even if, and when I was writing the fiction one time, I had some guy question me, some reader, about the distance from state office building to a hospital, and it was a fiction based on, but I relocated the incident to another community, and this reader thought he knew the hospital and so forth I was talking about, and it wasn't, but he said, I timed it, I clocked it, and it was 1.5 miles, and you said it was 1 mile. I said, oh, man. So you can get caught.
And are you worried about that guy now? Like when you're writing, you know, your next book, and you're not sure about a fact, it's like, you're like, okay, I got to make one more phone call, or I got to go out and do one more thing. If you're thinking about that guy, because that guy is out there, and he's always going to be checking on you. I mean, I totally get that experience. It's really funny. But those are the people who keep us really honest.
And on our toes, right? right, Lisa, right. I hate to say this, but we're just about out of time already. And before we get cut off, I want to thank you for being on. And I'm sure it's a fascinating read. I have a copy on order. So, and if I can just take the last few seconds here, and Lisa is going to be back with me on July 15th for not the Meet the Author show, but on Juror 13 show. We're going to get there into a little bit about Lisa's career as a journalist and covering high-profile cases for Court TV. So I'm looking forward to that, Lisa.
Me too. I can't wait, and I'll talk to you then.
Okay, and enjoy your vacation. I'm glad you're feeling better, and we'll talk to you on July 15th.
Thanks so much. Bye, Denny.
Bye-bye. Good night now. Okay, very interesting, and I can't wait to get my hands on that book. And thank you for listening in. I really appreciate it. And again, if you liked what you heard, Lisa, she'll be back with us on the Juror 13 show on July 15th. And I'm looking forward to that also. Thank you very much, everyone, and have a good night.